This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I bet when you woke up today, you didn't think that by the end of it, you would be hearing about Title II of the Communications Act of 1934 as amended. Did ya? Well, welcome to the internet, everybody. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 10th of November. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And yes, President Obama is in China today. Lots going on in Beijing. But he made news back here in a very, very big way. From the White House this morning came the president's most definitive remarks to date on something called net neutrality, the question of whether there ought to be fast lanes or correspondingly slower lanes on the internet. The president wants the FCC to regulate the internet the way they regulate phones, hence the aforementioned Title II. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The president has long been against special fast lanes online, but this is the most direct he's been, calling for, quote, an explicit ban on paid prioritization. And he wants the feds to treat internet companies like Comcast and Verizon like phone companies. They're under Title II of the law, which got a cheer from Craig Arendt at Free Press, which lobbies for such neutrality.
We're experiencing Title II right here. Your call to me gets treated the same way as your call to the White House. You get to decide what the priority is going to be.
For their part, internet providers proclaimed unprecedented government interference and a crippling future of Mother May I rules. Former FCC Commissioner Harold Furchtgott-Roth agrees. He's now with the Hudson Institute think tank.
Let me be clear. This is all about how do you regulate the internet? And the obvious answer is you regulate it in the same way you have for the past 20 years, which is not at all.
For all the sound bites, this issue is incredibly complicated, litigated, obfuscated. But MIT computer science professor Daniel Weitzner says the task really for the FCC is to keep the web working about as it does today.
We know that companies both on the network side and on the edge, as it were, the Amazons and Googles and Twitters of the world, have all been able to grow.
The issue is, some see the internet starting to move in the direction of pay-to-play, more speed for the rich. Weitzner says that's contrary to how it's worked until now, and that's the challenge for regulators. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We haven't talked about the housing market in a while, but the luxury home builder Toll Brothers had some good news for shareholders today. Revenues for the quarter that ended in October were up 29%. Strong demand, especially out here on the West Coast, boosted sales for them. But Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports if you happen to be looking for signs of a broad-based continuing housing recovery, you might have to wait just a little bit longer.
Toll Brothers calls itself the nation's leading builder of luxury homes. This past year, it's been aggressively expanding on the West Coast. In Southern California alone, it's developing five new communities. Morningstar analyst Jim Krapfel says Toll's quarterly numbers look good, but he wouldn't read too much into them.
It's really more a function of a higher community count, so more communities where the company is selling homes into, rather than any real acceleration in home buyer demand.
Toll's homes on average sell for more than $700,000. But it's not the only builder who's been targeting the higher end of the market. Economist Robert Dietz with the National Association of Home Builders says right now that's where the profits are.
Home builders have been serving the part of the market that's been the healthiest, which has been older move-up buyers that have home equity, that have more wealth, that have the ability to make that down payment to buy a newly built home.
And that trend has been reinforced by lenders chasing wealthy buyers, offering them surprisingly low rates on large jumbo mortgages, rates in some cases less than 3%, even lower than for standard loans. Housing economist Brad Hunter at Metro Study hopes by next year we'll see signs of a broader recovery in the home buying market.
Our take is that rents are getting so high and job formations are getting better.
That's apparently what the country's largest home builder is betting on. D.R. Horton is rolling out a middle-income brand called Express Homes, houses that sell for as low as $120,000. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was all right. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are 14 days left until the deadline for the U.S. and its allies to reach a deal with Iran over its nuclear ambitions. There will surely be long days and long nights around negotiating tables, but in the background lurks the reality that the U.S. and Israel, although they have never admitted it, have already done great damage to Iran's nuclear program. It was an unconventional attack in the most fundamental sense of that word. It wasn't a bomb or a missile, but a computer virus known as Stuxnet, the world's first digital weapon. Kim Zetter is a senior editor at Wired, and she is also the author of a new book about Stuxnet. It's called Countdown to Zero Day. Kim, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I guess maybe what we need to do is start with a quick description or definition of Stuxnet, would you? What is it?
So Stuxnet is a worm/virus malicious code that was launched against Iran's uranium enrichment program. It was discovered back in 2010, and it was designed not to steal anything, not to even harm the computers that it was infecting. It was designed to physically sabotage equipment that was being controlled by the computers that it infected.
How bad was it? Because I will tell you that reading this book, it makes it sound like Stuxnet was the cyber Armageddon, if you will.
Well, I guess a lot of people want you to think that. It was obviously caught prematurely due to some errors that the attackers made, and it could have been much more effective than it was.
Is it fair to say, even though neither side has acknowledged that they are the ones who created this device, if you will, is it fair to say that the Americans and the Israelis then launched a new age of cyber warfare with this thing?
It is fair. And I think that in some regards, this was perhaps a bit reckless. I mean, I think that, you know, people will be divided on whether this actually averted a kinetic war, because there was talk about Israel definitely wanted to, you know, launch an airstrike against Natanz. And this was an alternate. But on the other hand, as you point out, it opens the way for other countries to also use this kind of resolution for problems.
Natanz, of course, is the Iranian nuclear weapons facility, or nuclear facility, shall we say. But let me ask you this, and you point this out in the book. There is a strong case to be made that at some point in the not-too-distant future, this is going to bite us in the fanny, right? Because it's going to be pointed at us.
Yeah, what it did, I mean, Stuxnet really shunned this spotlight on these inherent vulnerabilities in systems that are 20 to 40 years old. Industrial control systems don't get replaced like your desktop system. They stick around for years, and they were never built for security.
Please tell me that you discovered in your reporting for this book that the National Command Authority and the government are spending as much money on defensive weapons as they are on things like Stuxnet.
Well, there's the thing.
okay, that's not what I wanted to hear.
So, no. But I want to point out something that doesn't get discussed very much, and that's the use of zero-day exploits.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, when researchers discover a vulnerability in a system like the Microsoft operating system or your Apple iOS system, they report it to the vendor so the vendor can patch it. And then, of course, we're all secure at that point. With zero-day exploits, when the government wants to use them for attack purposes, they keep this information secret. And so systems at home and elsewhere are kept vulnerable just for the purpose of using the same vulnerability to attack an enemy or an adversary system. So I think that it's a discussion that we've never really had in this country. And I think that hopefully Stuxnet will bring this discussion to the fore, and so that we really do decide as a country to defend our systems, or are we willing to leave systems vulnerable to attack so that we can attack others?
Genie's out of the bottle, right? There's no going back on this. I mean, digital weaponry is out there and deployed.
There's no going back. There's been talk about some kind of treaty or negotiations for what's off limits. We already have rules of war that cover kinetic warfare. You can't, you know, bomb a hospital, certain things like that. But with a digital weapon, you can avoid attribution. A digital weapon is much more secret than a physical weapon. It's harder to attribute who the attacker is in order to lay blame or responsibility afterward.
Kim Zetter, she is a senior writer at Wired. Her new book is called Countdown to Zero Day. It's about Stuxnet. It's a good read. Kim, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
You know how sometimes, and not that you'd ever do it, of course, but sometimes it's just easier to say, oh, no, man, I didn't get your text. Sorry, my bad. Rather than deal with what the actual text was all about. It is kind of the dog ate my homework line of the internet age. But for a while now, texts sent from iPhones to some Android users who used to have iPhones got caught up in a black hole. They just never showed up anywhere. Apple is out with a fix for that, but not before many, many stories of lost texts causing problems for businesses, their clients, and their customers. Nova Sappho has that story.
The iPhone to Android texting problem is familiar to Wayne Lamb.
Anecdotally, I've experienced it with my wife's friends.
Texts that were going through all of a sudden weren't. And while that might be fine for casual conversations, it can quickly lead to problems, says Lamb. He's a senior analyst with Telecom Electronics.
For my wife, for example, as a pharmacist, she needs to send out her meds on time and so forth, so she needs to communicate with drivers.
Independent telecom analyst Jeff Kagan says texting has become an important communication tool, not just within companies, but also out to customers.
Some businesses are really moving into this aggressively, and other competitors in the same space are not.
Kagan says we're in the early days, where those adopting texting have a competitive advantage. There are also a number of startups that see a growing market for secure business texting.
We think that the timing is good, and the need is very real.
Scott Irwin is with Rembrandt Venture Partners, which focuses on enterprise and business technologies. He says the growing need is also about how companies do day-to-day business.
Employees, they use various texting platforms in their personal lives, and that tends to bleed over into their professional lives as well. So this is creating the problem and therefore the opportunity.
Analysts say at some point there may be a shakeout among texting providers as the business world increasingly adapts to the technology. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bossy, but in a good way.
Yeah, sure. What exactly do CEOs do all day anyway? Our series, I've Always Wondered, but first, let's do the numbers. All right, at the risk of repeating myself, it was another record day on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial is up 0.2%, 39 points, closed at 17,613. The S&P 500 up 0.3%, 6 points, finished at 2,038. Those are both record highs. The NASDAQ advanced 0.4%, 19 points, 46.51 on the ticker there, but no record. The index is at a 14-year high, still, however, catching up to the glory days of the dot-com boom. President Obama's comments about net neutrality and regulating the internet were anything but neutral for cable companies. Charter Communications sank more than 6%. Time Warner off 5%. Comcast down 4% itself. Target hit the mark after an analyst upgraded shares in the big retailer. The stock jumped 2%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.36%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. The annual National Veterans Day observance at the Arlington National Cemetery will be taking place to honor all veterans who served and continue to serve in the military. Veterans Day was originally called Armistice Day when it was first celebrated on November 11, 1919. And it's been 20 years since the film adaptation of the best-selling novel Interview with the Vampire opened in theaters. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is a school of economic thought that goes a little bit like this. Things are improving here, sure, but part of that is because things are going so badly everywhere else. There is trouble in almost every direction. China, which is attempting the oh-so-difficult maneuver known as a soft landing. Then south to Brazil, where the boom has turned sour, and east over to Europe, where the malaise has barely lifted since the Great Recession officially did. But in those global economic woes, there are some bright spots for us, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
Not many Americans are dancing in the streets over our economy, but look around. Maybe we should be, says Paul Ashworth at Capital Economics in Toronto.
It may sound strange, but yeah, the U.S. is the standout performer of the G7.
The G7, that's Canada, Japan, and leading European economies. Europe hasn't fixed its rickety banks and risky government debt. Japan's struggling to break out of its lost decade of growth. China's slowing down. Russia's hurting from sanctions and plummeting oil prices. But here in the U.S.,
everything seems to be going in the right direction. The unemployment rate, a federal budget deficit below 3% of GDP.
And some of what ails the rest of the world actually juices up our economy. In an uncertain world, rich foreigners and overseas companies invest their money over here, explains Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
People buy up U.S. treasuries because, you know, the U.S. in the scheme of things looks relatively safe. That lowers interest rates. That means people could refinance their home, pay lower rates if they buy a car, get a car loan.
But there's a flip side. Our improving economy makes the U.S. dollar stronger. So we can buy more Italian sunglasses and Japanese cars and foreign oil, maybe. But for our companies that export, it's tough, because what they sell abroad gets more expensive. They could lose sales, which in turn could hurt job creation here at home. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I could get all metaphysical here and start off the setup of this next story with an observation about the nature of time, how it's a man-made construct, something not all that tangible. But I won't, because there is an actual substance, a chemical element that is essential to time as we know it, down to the umpteenth decimal point. The BBC's Justin Rowland stops by every now and then to shed some light on the economics behind the chemical elements. It's called Elemental Business, and up today is atomic number 55, symbol CS, cesium. Justin, good to talk to you again.
Very good to talk to you, Kai.
I will tell you the only thing I know about cesium is it moves really fast on the atomic level, and they use it for clocks, right?
Yeah, it moves fairly fast. That's absolutely right. It's a kind of silvery metal with a kind of goldish hue. It's got quite a low melting point. So it's about just over 24 degrees centigrade. It melts. So it's one of the few metals that's liquid at room temperature, along with, obviously, more famously, mercury. But its kind of key role is certainly cesium clocks, atomic clocks.
You went out, actually, to the, if we could call it, the birthplace of time, the Greenwich Observatory, right, and held some of this stuff in your hand, sort of?
No, we did not go to the Greenwich Observatory. We went to the National Physical Laboratory.
Right,
the Greenwich Observatory is, of course, where the Greenwich Meridian famously is.
Yes.
The National Physical Laboratory is actually where they calibrate time. There they keep a cesium fountain, no less.
Wow.
But don't think of the kind of fountain that might play in the gardens of a mansion. This looks more like a kind of domestic boiler with all sorts of kind of equipment attached to the bottom.
Once we know that cesium is inside of it, which we do, how does it work, this atomic clock thing?
That's very complicated, Guy. Basically, I mean, what they're looking for is something known as the transition of cesium. And that's when one of the electrons in the cesium atom shifts into a different orbit. And it emits a tiny kind of pulse of luminescence of light. And what they do is they fire microwaves at the cesium in order to make this transition happen. The transition happens at a very precise frequency. That frequency is used as essentially a pendulum in a clock, but much, much faster. So the transition of cesium happens at 9,192,631,770 hertz. That's very fast,
yeah.
Kai.
It is very fast. Now, did you ask all of these people when you were out there with these atomic clocks, did you ask them why we need things to be measured at the 9 trillion whatever it is hertz level?
We did indeed ask them, and the answer is that accurate timekeeping is incredibly important because, you know, super fast information networks need to know when messages were sent. For example, financial transactions that are done between London and New York are made at the time that they were said to be made, you know, so that you can make sure there isn't fraud taking place, for example. And essentially what the cesium clock does for the world is what railway time did for the railways. It sets a standard of timekeeping around the world. Satellite positioning systems, for example, need to calculate locations involving these huge distances between the satellites and where you are on Earth. And they do that using these very precise measurements of time.
That's it then, right? It's clocks for cesium?
Don't forget, cesium clocks were how the theory of relativity was proved. And it was done by the United States Naval Observatory, who sent cesium clocks out in planes, brought them back, looked at the minute differences between the clocks on the different planes and the clocks back at the Naval Observatory. And the time differences were exactly what Einstein had predicted, thereby giving evidence, proof, if you like, of the theory of relativity.
I knew that we would get the Americans in here somehow.
So you've got to give credit where credit's due.
Justin Rowland from the BBC. Thank you, Justin.
Cheers, Kai.
We talk a lot about CEOs on this program, a whole lot, because the decisions that CEOs make can matter to the business and, if it's a big enough company, to the rest of us as well. What we don't talk about all that much is what a listener named Leslie Evanson wrote in to ask us, which was, what do CEOs actually do all day? It's a good thing, then, that we've got a series where you all get to ask questions and we answer them. It is called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
Sally Herships has today's installment.
CEOs are busy. Most of the companies I contacted said their CEOs were too busy to let a reporter talk to them about what they do all day. So while I kept searching, I met with Andrea Pratt. He teaches economics at Columbia Business School and studies how CEOs spend their time. So what do CEOs do all day?
Over 80% of their time is spent in interaction with other people.
Meetings. CEOs go to meetings. And Pratt says most of the meetings are with people inside the company.
I mean, I feel like meetings have this reputation for being really, you know, they take too long, nothing gets accomplished.
Surprisingly, that's actually not what we find.
Pratt says the more time a CEO spends in meetings with employees, the better the company does. He says CEOs need to be steering the ship inside, which happens mostly via meetings. And that's what I finally found at the two companies that agreed to let me talk to their CEOs. First, Happy Family, which makes organic food for babies and kids. 37-year-old Shazi Visram is CEO.
So I wanted to go to the bathroom like 20 minutes ago, but see, that's what happens.
Visram is talking about getting sidetracked by trying to check in with her 80 full-time employees, something she says she tries to do whenever she's in her New York headquarters, like today. I trailed her for a whole day. There was a group meeting to look at sketches of designs for product packaging.
These feel very close to me.
A one-on-one check-in about the design of the company website.
It was sort of that mash of images.
So now this is all one section, so it's a timeline.
A meeting to taste test new potential products.
Banana, carrot, blackberry. Oh, that's runny. Didn't look like a good face. Oh, dear. Sorry.
And more meetings is what I found at Sealed Air, a New Jersey-based company with 25,000 employees. Among other products, it makes bubble wrap at a giant plant in Secaucus.
We have enough bubble wrap in here to reduce the whole level of stress worldwide by at least like 1 degree.
I just have to ask, do you guys ever come in here and pop the bubble wrap?
59-year-old Jerome Peribere is CEO, and after we toured his plant, he pulled out a printed itinerary of his schedule for the day.
So if you wanted to know how my day, like a typical day, is composed on. So this morning I arrived at the office around 7:15, 7:30.
He caught up on emails, he had a phone meeting, a town hall meeting, and the schedule for the rest of the day, more meetings.
That's going to be my day.
Okay.
Thank you. So let's go.
Back at Happy Family, Visram says she does a little bit of everything. Sales, marketing, management. She says being a CEO requires a certain personality type.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bossy. But in a good way. If a corporate culture is all about collaboration and there's no one person who can say, you know what, this is great, but we're going to do this and this is why, I think, you know, you're asking for chaos.
Andrea Pratt says CEOs put in just over 11 hours at work every day, but he says they probably work more. Visram says when she started her company, she could get so busy she used to sleep on the floor of her office with a little blue blanket and a yoga mat she still keeps in the corner. She was earning $36,000 a year. So when people bring up that touchy subject of high CEO pay,
I believe that for the folks that are in that position, and many of them have really earned it and they paid their dues.
Perry Bear says CEOs should be paid for the value they create.
You have CEOs who have created zero value during their tenure. I think it is unfair to have very high salaries from people who have created zero value.
Peribear says not everyone can do the job of CEO. You have to be able to lead an entire company. Then there are all those meetings and the long hours. It's the end of the day, and happy family CEO Shazi Visram still hasn't eaten lunch.
So 5 o'clock leaving the office, but the work continues.
Leaving the office to get out of the office in order to be able to do work.
In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Go ahead. Tell us what you've always wondered. We've got a spot you can do that on our homepage. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which, and I know I've said this a lot lately, so this will be it for a while, maybe, but this really is this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us. PepsiCo is testing, and I am sadly not making this up. Oh, how I wish I were. A Doritos-flavored version of Mountain Dew. The soda with nacho cheese chips. Go ahead. Top that. I dare you. All right, we got to go. That's it for the show today. The Dow up 0.2% today, 39 points. Record high, 17,613. The S&P 500 up 0.3%, 6 points, 2,038. The NASDAQ up 0.4%, 19 points on that index, 4,651 there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Tommy Andres, Daisy Palacios, and Gina Delvac. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. Have a good afternoon. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.